The experiment that we're starting today is our first experiment formally using alkenes. So I want to show you an example alkene mechanism, and this will be a little bit similar to what we did with SN1, SN2, except a much smaller lecture. I just want to give you this introduction, throw out a little bit of this terminology that we're going to be using, because we're very soon going to be coming to alkene reactions in lecture. So first I'm going to start with a simple example of what's called electrophilic addition. Now this mechanism does not match the one that occurs for today's experiment, but it's a simpler mechanism, which is why I want to start with it first. Let's say that we have an alkene such as but1-ene. So a little note about alkene nomenclature. I know that we reviewed a little bit of alkene nomenclature when we did the dehydration experiment, but I said at that time, don't worry about knowing the names. Now, if not for the quiz coming up, for the next exam, you do need to know how to name alkenes. So go back and review the names that we'd already done. And we do need to have another discussion on naming because we didn't finish talking about E and Z yet. So we will be coming back to it. But just want to throw that out there. Do start recognizing and working with names of alkenes. So this is but1-ene. And even though it is a compound that only has carbon and hydrogen, it is reactive. Can anybody come up with a reasonable explanation why this kind of molecule, even though it only has carbon and hydrogen, is reactive, whereas the alkanes that we had last week, I even mentioned this morning that alkanes generally are not reactive, which is why we even have the free radical halogenation reaction. What's the difference between an alkene and alkene? Why is this reactive? For carbon-carbon, pi bonds versus sigma bonds, the pi bond is easier to break. But even aside from that, if you think about a sigma bond, you've got electrons that are trapped between the two nuclei. But pi bonds, it's kind of like a sandwich, electron density above and below the connection between the two atoms. So somewhat more accessible electron density as well. So what can happen is that pair of electrons in the pi bond can be induced to reach out and attack something if that something it attacks really, really wants electrons. In other words, something that's an electrophile. And so that's why we have these electrophilic additions that can occur. Simplest kind is if we have an alcohol in solution with some form of acid catalyst, so some source of really strong acid. In other words, to simplify, H+ in solution. So the alkene can attack something like H+, and at the moment, really honestly, don't worry about where the H+ comes from. We'll have an extensive discussion of acid catalysts in the future. And sometimes, as long as you know that there's an H+ in solution, it doesn't necessarily always matter where it is coming from. The more important point is, where is it going to? Because the double bond used to be between two different atoms. When that pair of electrons reaches out to attack the hydrogen, it's only going to remain connected to one carbon or the other. Now, which of the two carbons does it make sense that the hydrogen would be connected to? The one on the right, the primary carbon, or the one on the left? Well, to answer that question, think about what would be left over. Once you open up that double bond and make a connection to one hydrogen, then what is left over? What will be on the other carbon? Well, if you open the bond up and nothing remains there, what happens to the carbon? You get a carbocation. So if you put the hydrogen on the primary carbon, you'll leave a carbocation on the secondary position. If you put the hydrogen on the secondary position instead, the carbocation is going to be on the primary. So which of those two possibilities is energetically more favorable? To leave the carbocation on the secondary position, because secondary carbocations are energetically more favorable than primaries, and the two possibilities come from the same starting molecule, so we can make an official energetic comparison. Secondary is going to be what happens. I won't write this down for now because we have the full discussion that we'll have later on, but this is known as Markovnikov addition, named after a researcher who did a lot of work with regiochemistry of this kind of reaction. Markovnikov addition just means following the natural tendency to go lower energy, that the secondary carbocation, when given this choice of secondary versus primary, is going to be the one that more likely forms. Now, I said, let's say for this example reaction, we have an alcohol as our solvent. Let's use ethanol just because it's easy to write. Thinking about the SN1 mechanism, which I know we haven't re-reviewed it yet, but we have talked about attacking carbocations before, how many different products are going to result after the alcohol attacks this carbocation? Why two? Because the carbocation is planar, which means attack can occur from the top or the bottom. That is going to generate a stereocenter at that position because we have a methyl group and an ethyl group attached to where the carbocation is. There's a hydrogen that's not written in there, but it's there. And then now we're going to be adding an alcohol, so four unique substituents. So from that one step of the alcohol attacking, we are going to get two different products. And as we have seen several times before, when we first have the alcohol attack, the oxygen is going to end up positively charged. You'll have a deprotonation, and you'll end up with two neutral products, ethers in this case. Now, let me pause for a moment. So, just to point out, I skimmed over this detail, but this is a cationic mechanism. We do form a carbocation as an intermediate, and that's going to end up being important in future examples because anytime that you form a carbocation, you've got the possibility for carbocation rearrangement. Now, rearrangement would not happen in this case because if you look at where the carbocation is, it's already on the secondary carbon. There are no tertiary carbons on this molecule to move to. And the only other secondary position is, in fact, chemically equivalent to the first secondary position. So it doesn't matter which one of those two carbons it ends up on, you'd have the same intermediate. And it's not likely it's going to move from the secondary to the primary. But I'm making this note because this class of mechanisms does have this problem. When you add to an alkene, you might get multiple products due to carbocation migration. Now, let me show you a different example reaction that much more closely matches the mechanism of what we're doing in today's experiment. And I'm going to use a simplified molecule. I used the actual starting material for today's lab when I did this in the other sections, but it takes a while to draw. Yes?
So yes. You expect some products where the carbocation you'd get hardly any product that way, actually, because energetically it's so unfavorable for that to occur, there wouldn't really be any reason for it to occur. Okay. Now, it might at elevated temperatures, but then you could make a kinetic argument as well, that maybe kinetically it would be more favorable at one position versus another. But then you get exactly the same molecule out.
Okay, in terms of distinct product, those would be able to...
Those are the only two reasonable products you would get, yes. Now let's see this other mechanism. And I'll use... Well, let me ask you, how would you name this? And use the E and Z instead of cis and trans. Because cis and trans would be valid to use in this case. But we're gonna have a strong preference for E and Z. So this is E. Why is it E? Because this is trans. Why is this trans? How would you express that? Using the vocabulary for alkenes that we've covered, using the terms face versus side. Okay, so we have a substituents on two different faces. And at the same time, on two different sides. More clearly put, on each side, there's a substituent that's on opposite faces. In that situation, that's trans. Trans is E. So this is E, but2-ene. It can react with molecular bromine. Which, let's pause for a minute and discuss, why would bromine react? And let me show you the mechanism first, I guess. So double bond would attack one of the bromines, kicking the other bromine out. Why might this be a favorable process? I mean, this indirectly is showing that bromine is going to be an electrophile. Why would it be? What's bromine's oxidation state at the beginning of this reaction? Zero, because by definition, elements in their natural forms have oxidation state zero, because they haven't gained or lost electrons yet. Haven't written up yet, but what one of the products is going to be is bromide, the Br minus ion. What is the oxidation state of that ion? -1. That means that bromine is being reduced, which means bromine is acting as an oxidizing agent, which is exactly what the halogens tend to do. Halogens want that -1 charge. So in many, many, many reactions, halogens act as oxidizing agents. It's doing the exact same thing here. So, bromine is being reduced from oxidation state from oxidation state 0 to -1, which is favorable. And again, another way of saying it is bromine is acting as an oxidizing agent. Now, bromine is rather unusual, though, and that's why this is a separate class of mechanisms, because bromine is one of these big, squishy ions. And what happens is that when the double bond attacks the bromine, it doesn't end up connected to just one carbon. And there's some evidence for that occurring, which when we tackle this in lecture, we'll go more extensively into. But in other words, the bromine kind of ends up straddling both of the carbons, making a cyclic form of intermediate. Now, before we get any further, let me tell you how I'm going to write this down on paper, because this part can get kind of confusing. So this molecule. The alkene itself is planar, so much like a carbocation, it can be attacked from the top or the bottom. So let's imagine that I was down at the bottom of the screen looking up at the alkene that's in the plane of the screen. And so let's say I'm down here looking at this with the bromine being on top or the bromine being on the bottom. From this perspective, looking up at it, the carbon-carbon bond would be in the plane of my observation. So if I imagine I'm looking here, I could see the carbon-carbon bond would be pointed perpendicular to me. So I'd be using a plane line to draw it. The bromine would either be directly above or below. So the bond to the bromine, I also would draw with a plane line. Now, the hybridization of this alkene is sp2 perfect. So that means it's planar. But once bromine is attached, once it reacts, what's going to be the hybridization of both of those carbons? After bromine makes a new bond, so you got four things attached to each carbon, what's going to hybridization be? It's going to be sp3, which means it's going to be tetrahedral. Which means if I'm looking at it from some direction, if two of the bonds are plane, one of the other ones has to be dashed, one of the others has to be wedge. Well, there's this methyl group that from my perspective down here would be pointed away from me, so I'm going to write it with a dash. There's this other methyl group that's going to be pointed towards me, and so I'm going to write it with a wedge. So here are the two different products I end up with. Now, this has the rather scary name of the cyclobromonium ion. But actually, the name's not that scary. The cyclo means cyclic. Bromonium means positively charged bromine. That I-U-M ending in general means something positively charged. So cyclobromonium ion means exactly this kind of structure. Bromine that's positively charged, part of a ring. The big deal is it's not a carbocation. It's not a carbonium ion. It's a bromonium ion. Moreover, it's a cyclic ion. That positive charge won't migrate around. There's not a carbocation shift because you don't have a carbocation. On top of that, because you formed a ring, there's a certain stereochemical effect that occurs. And again, the rationalization for why this happens is because bromine's big enough to straddle the two atoms. And there's evidence to show that for most substrates, when this reaction occurs, the ring doesn't open until something attacks and pushes the ring open. Well, what could attack in this case? The bromide that we kicked off in the just previous step. So bromide will come in and attack the ring. At that time, now the ring will open. It's a bit deceptive the way that you've seen me draw this, but it really is going to come from the opposite direction of bromine. So from the perspective of the way the alkene started out, we've got one bromine that reacted on the top, in this first example, the one I drew out. And then the second bromine is going to come and attack from the bottom. In other words, the two different faces of the alkene. You might ask, well, are there other reactions where you could have addition on the same face of the alkene? And the answer is yes. We'll see other reactions that do have that kind of addition. This form of addition, where it's on opposite faces, is known as anti-addition, just like the anti that you had for rotamers. If you did add on the same face, that's known as syn addition, just like that term syn that we had for rotamers. So I'm pointing it out just to make a differentiation from the first mechanism that we saw.
because on that first mechanism, there was no control of stereochemistry. You had the alkene that technically you could have had addition on the top or the bottom of that alkene to start with. You then had a bare carbocation, which could be attacked from the top or the bottom by the next thing that comes in. But here there's more control. Yes, the alkene can be attacked from the top or the bottom, but then the ring will only open when something attacks from the other side. Now, you do, of course, have attack at the left-hand position possible versus the right-hand position. But these molecules are mirror images of each other in this case, since I've got the same substituent on either side. So the two possibilities of pushing open the ring are going to generate the two possible products, no matter which ring that I show opening. Because we're going to do this again in lecture later on, I'm going to skim over detail just for the moment and show you the end product results. Oops, darn, nope, wrong. There we go. Now, since you would be forming these two products in equal proportion, then you're going to end up with an optically inactive product mixture. So this is the second kind of mechanism, forming a ring and then having that ring attacked. Turns out in today's lab, this isn't even quite the right mechanism, which I know it doesn't discuss mechanism much. I think it's only a paragraph in the theory part for this experiment. But it does mention something unusual that happens because we have a reaction going on at the position, one position away from a benzene ring. So this kind of structural motif, does anybody remember what that is called? Having a position, one position away from a benzene ring. And the name came up when we had that list of alkyl halides in the SN1, SN2 lab that we tangentially discussed this morning. This is the benzyl group. And benzyl, I'll make the following statement. Benzyl carbocations can form even if they're primary. I'll leave myself space to write the explanation why, but let's see if we can come up with a rational explanation why. Why would a carbocation like this be favorable even if R, that I've shown here, is a hydrogen? Well, someone this morning referred to benzene's unusual reactivity. Which, if you look at that, what would be the hybridization for every carbon in the benzene ring?
SP2.
Right, because the hydrogens aren't written in, but every position, therefore, only has connections to three different atoms. So if each one of those positions is SP2 hybridized, that means each one of those positions in this hybridization model has a p orbital on it. Well, let's draw a frame diagram of that carbocation there. Frame meaning I'm not going to draw in
the orbitals for sp2 or sp3 hybridization. I'm going to simplify and just show the p orbitals. The special reactivity of benzene comes from the fact that all six of these orbitals are circularly conjugated. And in fact, this is something known as aromaticity. When you say something is aromatic in chemistry, it doesn't mean that it smells. It does happen coincidentally that many, many aromatic compounds have a fragrance, which is, I assume, where the term originally came from. But aromaticity is a special souped-up version of conjugation that causes even more stabilization of a molecule than conjugation itself. What is the hybridization of the carbon in this example where the carbocation is? It's also sp2 hybridized, which also means it has a p orbital, which also therefore means it can overlap with that same pi system from the benzene ring. Well, that's not hyperconjugation. This is actual conjugation, because you have a full orbital overlap that's possible. So that conjugation, that spreading out of the positive charge, is so favorable that that's why a benzyl carbocation can form, even though it might be primary. So let me finish the sentence I've got here. Benzyl carbocations can form even if they are primary due to conjugation with the neighboring benzene ring. Now, why am I bringing this point up? Well, what if we had done this mechanism with bromine, but with our actual starting material? Which, what is our starting material? E-stilbene. Stilbene is a common name for a double bond that has two phenyl groups on it. So this morning I identified, actually, that phenyl is the substituent name for benzene. So the real name of this molecule would be E-1,2-diphenylethene. Now notice in that name, we don't use a 1 before the ene. Exactly the same way in which we don't use a 1 when we're naming ethanol. Because there is no such molecule, ethane-2-ol. There is no such molecule as F2-ene, because it would be F1-ene. So for that reason, we just call it ethene. Let's say that that reacted with bromine. So the reaction mechanism, one way to show the reaction mechanism is the double bond attacking the bromine and kicking bromide off. What would result is one of these cyclobromonium ions. I'm only going to draw one, because I don't want to draw the full mechanism for this out. I want to get at why it differs from the standard mechanism. Your text suggests that it differs exactly for this reason, that normally when we form these cyclobromonium intermediates, they get attacked by something and that is what pops the ring open. But a benzyl carbocation is so favorable that this ring can open up all by its own self. And if it does, then on the side of the molecule that did not open, we still have a stereocenter. On the side of the molecule that did open, we have a carbocation. Because of that, it can be attacked from either side, independent of what the original ring's orientation is. So again, in the first bromination reaction we saw, the bromine spanned the two carbons and locked in a certain way the configuration of that molecule. Or better way of saying it, it caused the next attack to occur from a certain direction. But if that ring opens all by itself, you lose this stereochemical control. Now whatever comes in can attack from either side. So in fact, let me write that in. The carbocation can be attacked from either side. So what that results in is the formation of one more product. To show you the three possible products, let me rewrite the way that I'm showing all of these types of compounds. So once the reaction is completed, you've just got single bound carbons. So sigma bonds can rotate. I'm going to rotate these molecules so that the two phenyl groups are in the plane of the paper. And so it's just the bromines that I'm writing in or out. So if you think of it this way, potentially you have four combinations of what's going to result. One bromine being pointed towards you, the other one also pointed towards you. First one pointed towards you, second one away from you. First one away from you, second towards you, first one away from you, second one away from you. So let me write those four products out. And actually, to make all of our lives a little easier, and show you that sometimes a benzene ring is written with the Greek letter phi. Phi for phenyl. So instead of having to write the benzene ring over and over and over again, I could do this. So again, I've turned the benzene rings to be in the same plane, and now let's look at the four stereochemical possibilities. Both bromines towards, one bromine or the other towards, the other away. And then both of them pointing away. Now the two structures I just wrote on top, what's the stereochemical relationship between the two of them? They're diastereomers, right, because only one of the two stereocenters has been changed. You could also, therefore, call these epimers of each other. What would be the stereochemical relationship of the two molecules on the left? They'd also be diastereomers, right, because, again, there's only one stereocenter that's changed. What about the lower left and the upper right? What's the relationship there? They're enantiomers because everything is opposite. What is the relationship between the upper left and the lower right? Oh, I think I heard a few of you say the right answer. There is no relationship. They're the same molecule. Why? Because look, a mirror plane can be drawn right through the molecule, which means it's meso. And so all you do to make this change is pick the molecule up, turn it 180 degrees around, put it back down, and you get the other molecule again. So really, there's only three products in this case that results because the molecule ends up with some symmetry. So we have still the racemic mixture of the lower left and upper right hand products. But now we're going to also have this meso compound that forms, which would not have formed if this ring did not open. And that's what that little paragraph in your lab text is trying to get at. So, this mechanism we're going to review in the future. Let me move on now talking about how to do the reaction. So you have another example of what I call a shake and bake reaction. You put in your original still bean, you have your bromine. Be careful because there are or were two different bottles of bromine in there. There's actually a bottle of bromine for your previous experiments, the dehydration lab. And I totally omitted discussing the use of bromine in that lab, so let me backtrack a bit. The last lab where you made all these different alkenes, the last thing to do before you throw your sample away is to put some of the bromine, the lower concentration bromine, into that sample and see if the color disappears. Why? Well, bromine reacts with alkenes. Bromine's what causes the solution to be brown in color. And so if you have an alkene present, it will cause bromine's color to disappear. That's our double check to prove, just qualitatively, that we did form alkenes in the last lab. Because if the bromine disappears, well, our assumption is going to be is we successfully made some alkene that's reacting with that bromine. So I don't remember if it's 0.1 or 0.2 molar, but whatever the lower concentration bromine in the fume hood is right now, that's for the previous experiment.
So if
the color disappears by just putting a drop or so in there. Of course, if you put too much bromine in, then you're making a bromine solution. But if you just put a drop or so in and that color disappears, that's a positive test for an alkene. Of course, we're still saving our products for the moment for gas chromatography, so don't do this until we've made it through that. Just pointing out that you grab the correct bottle for today's experiment, which is 1 molar bromine. And we will be doing full quantities for today's lab. Meaning we're not going to cut the quantities in half or third or anything for today. Right, so as written, we're doing it. So you mix everything together, the crystals, the product happens to have a different solubility than the reactant, so it's just going to crash out of solution, very convenient reaction, in fact. You then collect those crystals, and then you're supposed to wash them, correct? Which, a little bit of random nomenclature that came up in one of the other sections. The CH3 group itself, even if it's not the only part of a substituent, you still might look at the end of a molecule and refer to, oh, this methyl group, meaning this CH3 group. There is actually a common word for the CH2 group, one that might be in the middle of the chain, and that is known as methylene. That ending coming from certain systematic nomenclature, IUPAC nomenclature, that tackles what's called divalent radicals like this. But if you put chlorine on either side of this, get CH2Cl2, that's methylene chloride, the common name for the solvent that you're going to be using to wash off the crystals after you filter them. Now, it says to do the following. Wash the crystals until they are white in color, correct? Do you all know what the color white is? Then do you need to ask me, is this white enough? I mean, I haven't done this lab my own self ever. I've watched other students do it a number of times. But in other words, you need to trust your own judgment as to whether you think the crystals are really washed or not. And I'll give you two things to consider as you do it, though. One, no matter what solvent you have, there's always going to be some non-zero amount of your solute that might end up being soluble. Now, I presume that methylene chloride was chosen in this case because maybe it doesn't have very good solubility. But the more methylene chloride you use, the more potential for product loss you therefore have. Another thing to consider, though, is once you're done with the crystals, are you really done? Once you've filtered and washed your crystals, is that it? No, what else is happening? Recrystallization. So if you're going to be recrystallizing to get rid of the impurities anyway, do you really need to sit there and flush and flush and flush and flush the crystals in the first place? Probably not. So do a couple of washes, get that color close to white, and then don't worry too much about it because you're going to recrystallize. Now, what are you recrystallizing from? Xylenes. And it is plural in this case because the molecule xylene itself, there are three different versions. This is our first introduction to relative nomenclature terms of benzene compounds. So xylene is a benzene ring that has two methyl groups on it. And those methyl groups can either be totally opposite each other, they could be right next to each other, or you have this intermediate case where there's an intervening carbon. So these three different substitution patterns are known as para, meta, and ortho. Which this brings one of the rare opportunities for me to interject, and I will admit ahead of time, it's very weak, but a little bit of chemical humor. Why? Well, because we have the structure of benzene, of course. So what would that molecule be? Mercedes benzene, right. Because of the logo in the middle. I told you it was weak humor, but I have to get it where I can get it, right? Along with that, this is a rather perplexing molecule. Can anybody figure out why? Paramedics, or paradox, actually. Because MD, you know, doctor, paraposition, paradox. At least I got a reaction out of you. Shall we move on from the humor then? Anyways, the point of all this is to make you remember that there's something about this benzene orientation of substituents. So if you can remember paradox, you'll remember the para position. And then we've got meta and ortho. Xylenes plural, we have these three different isomers of xylenes. So the combination of the three together are the xylenes. Let's just remind ourselves of how recrystallizations work. Boy, I can hear myself in this room for once. amazing. So first you have both the xylenes and your target compound that you heat up at the same time. Because remember that any excess solvent that you use beyond what you really need, there's always a residual solubility of your target compound in that solvent. So the more solvent you use, the more compound you're going to lose. So you're heating up both at the same time so they can transfer just little bits of the xylenes over a little portion at a time. And then you keep doing this process until barely at the point where everything dissolves. Now, things to watch out for, though, the same type of thing that we discussed back when we first did recrystallization, is that you might melt your product at the same time that you're trying to heat up the xylenes. And that's okay that that happens, but that therefore you want to make sure you don't have two layers of liquid. Because if you do, that means you have melted product, and then your solvent, but they're forming two layers, which means they're not dissolving with each other. So if you get two liquid layers, you need to keep adding solvent until you do get just one unified layer. Once you do have everything dissolved, you then let it cool back down to room temperature first, then you put it in an ice bath, and then you can collect those crystals. If the power comes back on, and you all are around to do lab, if you run out of time to finish the recrystallization, all you have to do is cool down your mixture and then stopper it. Because if you didn't get to the point where you added enough solvent, the worst thing that's going to happen is solvent might evaporate. Now, you can't leave something with a liquid open, uncontained. Solids you can, liquids you can't. So you would need to go ahead and stopper, and then I'd recommend parafilming it, just so we don't waste solvent. Fortunately, xylenes has a boiling point of around 137, so it doesn't evaporate nearly as easily as some of the products that we've been making recently. But were we to get power back to, oh gosh, the NMR. Well, we might not have that today then now. If we get power back, do your reaction first, do your recrystallization. Those of you that have IRs, for the couple of you that were trying to dry out your products more thoroughly to see whether you did have water versus alcohol in your dehydration reaction, you could go ahead and do that. If the power comes back, I'm going to hope that the NMR is still calibrated enough that we could use it if any of you get to that point. I already was thinking not to fire up the GC because it's got a ramp time to heat up and we might not even use it today. And especially now if the power's out, can't use it. And so at this point, I guess we'll just wait 5 minutes, enjoy the silence of the room, and then disperse if no power comes on.